All right. So this is Jillian Hinderleiter. It is September 30th, 2016. I am interviewing Claire White for USC's Public History Program Archive. We are conducting this interview over Skype between Columbia, South Carolina and Las Vegas, Nevada. Okay, so that's all we had to do for our little intro.
Excellent.
So the first question we're asking everybody is, what motivated you to volunteer to be interviewed?
So first of all, I think that I'm a little self-absorbed. I like talking about myself. But honestly, joking aside, I've been on your side of the recorder and I've never been on this side of the recorder. So I think that was a big thing. I think that it makes you a better interviewer to be an interviewee. And I thought that would be so cool. And I think everyone has mixed feelings about having been in grad school. It's a emotionally and mentally tough time, but I was so thankful for my experience at USC. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, anytime that I can give back in small ways, especially non-monetarily small ways, I'm happy to do it.
Well, excellent. We're happy to have you. And I meant to mention, I said it in the email, but just to remind you, I'm technically a PhD student at USC, but I earned a public history master's in Boston. So at Northeastern University. So I have been on at both ends kind of the grad school history department experience.
Excellent.
So, you know, talking about USC and public history in general, why did you choose this program?
Well, my biggest motivating factor was the ability to do graduate assistantships in the public history field as opposed to being a teaching assistant. My first semester at USC, I actually did wind up being a TA, and it was certainly good experience, but I already had classroom experience at high school level. Mm-hmm. I had been a teacher and a long-term sub, and I thought, you know, I know that I don't want to teach. That's not what I want to do. So it would be great to find a program that allows you opportunities in a field more closely aligned with what my professional goals were. I haven't really kept up with it. I don't know how many graduate programs today in 2016 offer that, but, you know, back in 2009, which isn't that long ago, only 7 years ago, there were very few programs that could be said for. There are certainly a lot of programs I think that are equaled in their ability to match you in internships and things like that, but I wanted to be doing that kind of stuff the whole time I was in grad school, and that was the big motivating factor. And I wanted to move to the East Coast. Almost all of the schools that I applied to were in sort of the Mid-Atlantic to the Southeast region. So that was certainly part of it. And, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, they gave me an roughly equal amount of funding to other programs that I applied to. But more than anything, it was definitely the opportunity to work in assistantships that were outside of just being a TA, and I don't mean to diminish being a TA, but
but you know, something about public history is that it's really geared towards practicality, and so that kind of inspired one of the goals you had.
Exactly. Yeah, I definitely, yeah, that's a good way to put it, because I do think of myself as a pretty practical and pragmatic person. I was looking for, in my opinion, what was going to be the easiest path to finding a job that was better than the job that I had before I went to grad school.
Right.
And by all accounts of students who were current students at the time, of the conversations that I had with professors, of alumni that I'd spoken to, it seemed like USC could do that as well or better than anywhere else that I applied to.
Great. And so when you were looking at programs, you mentioned Mid-Atlantic, you mentioned Southeast in general. Why did you choose to enter a public history program versus something like museum ed or an archival program? What kind of moved you in the public history direction?
So I think for me, what I really was looking for was the intellectual background. And I wanted to find, so first of all, I was only looking at graduate programs that were housed within history departments. So nothing in art history, nothing in, you know, museology or fine arts. I had a history background coming in. I had worked at a history museum in college, and I thought that that was a comfortable place for me to be. And I, as I mentioned, I had taught as a teacher and as a long-term sub prior to going to graduate school. And so I felt, you know, I wasn't really sure, do I want to go into museum education? Do I want to become a curator? And I thought, what skills don't I have? And I felt that I had a lot of the teaching and pedagogical skills, but that I didn't have the same background in sort of like what causes people to go to museums and be interested in museums. Are we still connected? You're like,
yeah,
you're completely frozen.
Okay, so you were flashing a little bit. I can hear you. You're coming in clear, so hopefully
okay.
I don't.
Oh, you're not frozen anymore.
Okay. Okay, yeah, your voice is coming in strong, so you know, if it does drop, I'll pause it and we'll pick up where we left
okay.
off. But, I apologize. I am here. I'm listening.
No. I just wanted to make sure. You were frozen for a good amount of time before I said anything. And I thought, oh gosh, is she still there?
No. I'm here. I saw that my light was flashing a little bit and I'm like, but your audio is clear. So, right.
Great. Wonderful. I thought that I needed a little more of the theory, and I wanted a program that I felt if I did decide to go in museum education that it would be possible, but that I'd learn a lot about curatorial skills and I hate to say it, exhibition development, because I already knew I was more interested in like content development than like physically, like spatially coming up with exhibits.
Right.
So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I mean, let's dive right in there. So, you know, what sort of classes did you take when you were here? And, you know, you were in the museum tracks, correct?
Yes.
Right.
I was.
So,
I was in the museum track.
Yep.
And I'm a big dork. I'm such a historian that I forced myself to buy memory, write out what classes I was in. In anticipation of this question, and then I went back through all my old computer files and confirmed that that the written record indicated that I was correct in my assessment of what class.
That's the kind of interviewee we want. Prepare. That's what I like.
Right? I know. I was thinking, like, man, in a way, I would be really like annoyed if someone did this when I was doing them in oral history, if they were like looking at their notes. But then on the other hand, it's a good indication that they've thought about this very.
I think it's wonderful. So there's not going to be any ums and ahs. You will remember.
I'm trying. Also, I have the benefit of, you know, having only left the program like 6 years ago. So that's a positive, I'm sure, for my memory. But to get on to the question, so I took primarily in the public history track museum classes. My first semester was the material culture class, which I took with Allison Marsh, mm-hmm. and of which I think, unless she's made big changes to the class, most people who take it would describe it as the class where you have to write object labels every single week, just more and more object labels for the objects you brought, for other people's objects, just pile on the object labels. I couldn't find the name of what this course was from like a course catalog perspective, but it was definitely like the history of museum theory class. I took that in the spring of 2010, so in my second semester. In the first semester of my second year, so in the fall of 2010, my third full semester, I took a exhibit design class, which was one of those joint classes that they do with the McKissick staff. So it was taught by Lana Burgess. I think she's still there at McKissick. Is that correct?
As far as I know, I think someone else mentioned that she's still offering those sorts of classes. So I haven't taken it, you know, because I have the master's in public history, but right. I hear from the other MA students that that's something that they're in, and I'm pretty sure it's the same professor.
Got it. And then the last museum-focused class that I took was actually a special offering. It was creating an exhibit on factory tours in conjunction with Allison Marsh based on, you know, some of her dissertation research, but then research that all of us in the class had done as well. And so we did sort of like the first phases of planning and development and design. And then I can't remember if it was definitely after I had already completed my degree, but I don't know if it was the summer or the following fall that they actually created the exhibit with a different course. So that's kind of cool, but it was sort of like I was already in Massachusetts by the time it was completed. So other than pictures and like getting to see the exhibit brochure, I don't really know what happened with that.
It's funny because sometimes that's the way it works in real life, you know, with different exhibits and projects.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that's so funny because, yes, we were at the very when I left my job in Massachusetts, which was the position that had sort of evolved out of what I had done right when I finished graduate school. We were in like the very end phases of something that I had been working on for like 3 years. And the person who had started it with me had been an intern, and she was like now a full-time employee. And she was like texting me all these things like, I can't believe you left before we finished this. And I'm like, it's your project. It's not really mine. Like, I'm not that concerned. I'm very happy it's completed. We needed this particular thing, but it's okay. I'm not going to die not seeing it.
So, did you take any other classes that didn't necessarily fall within that museum track, or?
Definitely. So the only other public history class that I took was the Charleston Field School, which was so fun. And that was like, that's just, it's fun because I think it's one of those classes that most of the public history MA students want to take regardless of what track they're in. So it's a really good opportunity for collaboration and seeing things from another perspective, as opposed to some of the museum classes where it's like there's a few PhD students and there's a few preservation students, but it's pretty much just like 6 or 7 museum students and then like 2 other people who are like, whoa, what's up with this like monoculture going on here? So that was awesome. It was fun, you know, every other Friday going down to Charleston and one thing I remember, no one cared what van we got into in the morning, but in the evening when we drove back, if you got into Dr. Wymeth's van, he would ask these like really pointed questions about what we'd seen, and so you just, no one wanted to be in his van. Everyone would like rush to get into one of the other 2 vans. And I always wondered if it was just, I mean, it couldn't have just been our year. I'm sure every time he did Charleston Field School that happened, but every time. In the morning, we were all like, oh, cool, whatever, we like everybody, who cares what van we're in? And then in the afternoon, it would be like, oh, I'm not getting stuck with Dr. Wymeth again, no. And it was only because of his questions, because he'd always be like, so what did you really think about that? And you're like, it's 5:30, we're stuck in traffic, like, I don't want to think about it.
So you seem to have some really vivid memories about the classes that you're in, which is great. I remember, you know, in mine as well, it was always kind of the same batch of people that seemed to be in a lot of the classes, and that's kind of the way a lot of public history programs tend to be. So kind of besides the Charleston Field School, does anything else kind of like stand out when you look back at the coursework that you did at USC?
I think the classes that I definitely have.
Call dropped. Pause. Okay, I think that we're back on in recording. So you were talking about your classes, kind of anything that really stuck out to you.
Yes. So I think intellectually the classes that I've sort of called upon the most and that I think back about the most were the one where we created the exhibit for McKissick. And like I said, we didn't actually do the mounting of the exhibit, but where we did all the exhibit script for it. And then even more so, my history of museum theory, or like I said, I can't remember the name of that class,
okay.
But whatever the name of it was definitely about museum theory and the history of it. And I just, what I liked about that class, and actually what I liked about Allison Marsh's classes in general, and it forced you to be a little more thoughtful, but that's a good thing in grad school. She would always have us contribute our suggestions to the reading list. So in all of the classes that we took with her, and I don't know if this is something she still does, but, you know, she might have one or two books and that was it. And, you know, when you were looking through the syllabus at first, you're like, why are we only reading two books? This is grad school. And then she'd explain, well, every other week we're going to read books that you suggested. And, you know, it one, forces you to be a little more active in your own education. And two, it sort of starts you off from the very beginning, sort of having a sense of where everyone else is coming from, but doing so in what I would consider a pretty non-confrontational way. I mean, if someone suggests a book that you're like, that's super boring, I'm not interested in that, you may get into a debate about whether that should be read, or, you know, maybe they suggest an author and you're like, oh, I don't like that author. I've read their other works and I don't agree with anything they say. But essentially, you haven't even read the book yet, or maybe you have, and, you know, but you're coming from this position where you can debate and you can discuss, but you're doing it sort of safely. I mean, I hate to say that you know, no wars have been started over reading lists, but essentially, I'm not aware of any that have been directly attributed to crafting a grad school reading list. I just remember one of the books we read in that class was Newtown Square, and it was terrible. Like, every single person in the whole class agreed that just nothing had been said in this book. And within reason, I mean, if a terrible book is like 500 pages, I don't like it very much. But if it's just like a 200-300 page book and it's terrible, that was always my very favorite in grad school, because you really develop your voice and your ability to dissect an argument when you're looking at a book that has so many things that you can say is wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And I think as a public historian and as a historian, to me, the history of the thing that I do is so interesting. Right now at my job at the Mob Museum, I do not work with very many public historians. There is only two other people on our whole full-time staff of like 30 who have public history degrees. And of the other ones, there's only like three or four other people who've worked at any other museum before. Las Vegas is not a big museum place. We're not Chicago or Boston or San Francisco. So it's tough to fill museum positions with, you know, tenured museum professionals. And I'll tell them, oh yeah, such and such is how things used to be done in museums. Like, I was just recently talking about, like, cycloramas and using, like, pictures on the wall. And everyone was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never seen that in a museum. And I was like, well, I mean, it's from like 100 years ago. And they're like, oh, okay, so when no one that comes to a museum was alive. And I'm like, it's important. It's very important to know where museums came from. So I think that's what helps me sort of remember that class in particular. Mm-hmm. And I know I haven't talked a lot about any of my non-public history classes, but my reading seminars, I mean, I definitely, there are so many books that I can remember just like to this day. I'm like, man, that book was so terrible. Like, why did so-and-so suggest we read it? And almost every time it's because they know it's terrible and they want you to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. We read, I took the colonial period reading seminar with Daniel Littlefield, and we read a book, Jesus is Female, about Moravians. And oh my gosh, I mean, the whole book was essentially saying, like, it says essentially that Moravians believed these extremely outlandish things that are completely unprecedented. And what the book says is half of it is just not true, because tons of other early colonial religions believed these things. And the other half of it is not true, because there's like no proof that the Moravians actually believed the things that he said that they believed. And it's, I think it's Aaron Fogelman wrote the book, and you're just like, oh my God, what's happening here? And that was like the best. And that class was funny because Daniel Littlefield is one of those professors who will like just let you keep talking, he'll let you say some stuff, and then you get to a point and he's like, that's wrong, that's literally wrong, so I'm gonna break down to you why it's wrong, and even though you're supposed to be leading the discussion, I'll just talk for the next half an hour because you've really let this one go downhill. And that was fun.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you've had these museum classes with kind of a mixed bag of students, you know, PhDs, MAs, people from the library school or something like that. Mm-hmm. And also you have your kind of more traditional reading seminars. So did you notice, you know, kind of a dynamic between the public history MAs and the larger history program? Or, you know, what was that like in the years that you were here?
You know, that was one thing that when I was thinking about this oral history and preparing for this oral history, I knew that there was going to be that question, and I sort of braced myself for how I want to answer it. I felt that the public history program on a whole was very well supported in my time at USC between 2009 and 2011. The department chairs at the time and sort of the professors who were big decision makers at the time had a lot of respect and a lot of support for the public history program. And I think that is one real benefit, to USC's credit, that because of the age and the, success of the public history program in general, that it receives a little more respect than public history programs in some universities do. And I wouldn't want to downplay that point, because as a department, I always felt that we were very much included and very much supported. But the one thing that I always found a little challenging was I felt like individual PhD students and professors were always challenging, like, well, why are you a public history student? Why wouldn't you want to become a professor? What are you doing? You just want a terminal master's degree? Like, that's, what a waste. How silly. What are you going to do with that? And so I went to, I did my undergraduate at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which obviously is miles and miles away from South Carolina. But oddly enough, the year that I started, two other students from UNLV also started, both in the PhD program. Part of that is that one of the professors at UNLV had done his PhD at USC. So there was a lot of like pro USC stuff. And so they were attracted to it for the sort of transatlantic studies and the positive reviews that they'd heard from our professor at UNLV. But both of them just constantly were like, I don't understand. Like, you were so smart and so motivated at UNLV. Why do you just want a master's degree? And I'm like, I don't know what to say to that. It's a perfectly viable option. And especially going into museum education, I mean, it's not that I wouldn't ever consider a PhD, but to get a entry-level museum education position or even a mid-level, if you have a PhD, that can almost be a hindrance. So you have to sort of find that middle ground. How much experience do you have versus how much school do you have? And knowing that I wanted to come at some point back to Nevada, I just thought, I don't know if that's something that would at this point in my career benefit me. And I feel honestly like I got that from both professors and other students. Mm-hmm. And I know that I wasn't the only student who got it. It wasn't necessarily based on merit or personality or anything. It was just sort of like, well, you're smart enough to get a master's degree. Why don't you want to, defect from public history and get a PhD? So that was always, I felt sometimes that some professors sent a mixed message, that they would be very proud of the public history department being a part of the sort of history department family, but then they were always trying to poach.
Right. Sometimes there seemed to be a bit of a disconnect right there.
Yes. Yeah.
I see. Mm-hmm. So you already mentioned that you kind of liked the way Dr. Marsh set up some of her classes with the whole, like, you know, suggest a book, you know, as a group, we'll do this as kind of a collaborative enterprise. Were there any other influential or memorable professors that you had in the public history program that you kind of think of when you think about how to teach or theorize public history?
Dr. Marsh definitely had the biggest impact on me intellectually. And when I think back and when I think, like, what's the best practice here from a theoretical standpoint? But the other professor who had a big impact on me was Dr. Tom Brown, who isn't technically a public history professor. I know he's done sort of colloquium classes here and there, but he was my second reader for my thesis, and I had my whatever it's called, the antebellum period reading seminar with him. And he was, what I really liked, I mean, he was an amazing professor and a great mentor in general, but what makes me think back to him a lot also is that he was one of those people who was just really open to any new idea, to experimenting with things. And I think he's one of the traditional history professors who I look at and I think, like, he doesn't see himself necessarily as a public historian, but he talks about memory and memorialization in a lot of the academic topics that he studies. And he just always towed that line between, he wasn't going around saying, like, I'm a public historian, listen to me. But he would say, you know, little things like, oh, well, have you considered this? And he was just, he was always the person who would come up with, like, the most off the wall suggestions for how to get around problems. So my thesis was on James Woodrow, who had been a Presbyterian minister and a professor at the seminary in South Carolina, and then later became the president of South Carolina College. I guess he was president after it had already become University of South Carolina. I should probably know that since I wrote my thesis on it, but
it's been a little bit.
You know, it's hard when things change names, and he was definitely a professor when it was still South Carolina College. So I can't remember if he was president after it had already changed names. I think he was. But he had been a, he had taught geology and a couple of other scientific subjects at South Carolina College, and I was trying to figure out how to ascertain some of his beliefs from a religious and scientific mm-hmm. perspective. And Dr. Brown was like, you should go to McKissick and like look at his specimen collections. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he says, well, doesn't he have all those rocks? Like, there's rocks there. Maybe he's made some notes about the rocks. I'll tell you, he didn't. We never found any notes he made about any of those rocks. But it was a wonderful out-of-the-box suggestion, and especially for a non-public historian to say, like, go look for geological artifacts and maybe they'll help you with your thesis. I mean, that's a lot of public historians probably wouldn't even have made that suggestion. So he was a big one, and he was extremely supportive. He would be the exact opposite of the disconnect that I talked about as far as some professors. I mean, he was just so supportive, mm-hmm. I think, of the public history program and students.
Well, wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that. And so, you know, while we're kind of talking about Woodrow and your thesis a little bit, how did you kind of come to that thesis topic?
So I came to USC knowing that from a sort of intellectual topical perspective that the intersection between American religious history and intellectual thought was what I wanted to study. My undergraduate thesis had been about the role of Baptist church discipline in a sort of community control in frontier communities. And it's always been, I've always liked looking at religious history from a more cultural perspective and a more sociological perspective. And so I stuck with that. I knew that it had to be something that in some way encompassed that world of looking at a religious topic, but like completely throwing out all of the frameworks that religious historians usually use and using more of a cultural and intellectual lens. And this sounds so silly, but you know, when you're applying for grad school, there's only so much that you can look into. I mean, you have to figure out where you're going to get the best funding and who's the best professors to work with and where you're going to want to live and not going to have to shovel snow and things like that. And there's just so many things. And for whatever reason, one of the things that I didn't even consider was how robust or not the religious landscape of South Carolina was. I mean, it's the South, so it must have always been really religious, right? No, wrong. Especially by what we would describe as like Southern standards and also like 19th century standards of religiosity, South Carolina was very far down on the list for many years. And so I came in and was like, oh, okay, so there's literally no Baptists that I can like get a good enough topic on, so I'm gonna have to ignore them, can't go back to them. And I sort of went through, you know, all the evangelical American bred religions, and the Presbyterian community has always been a strong one in South Carolina, relatively strong, I should say. And Dr. Brown, actually, as I was sort of working through all of this, was like, well, what about James Woodrow? I mean, he was the president here, so we have his papers. He was a Presbyterian minister. Mm-hmm. He, like, fits all these categories. And so I thought, okay, well, that's one place to start. And you know, you never know, are you going to wind up going deeper into the topic that someone suggests to you, or are you going to find an ancillary topic? And in the case of Woodrow, I discovered pretty early on that he'd had this relatively big instance of teaching evolution to students at the seminary, you know, within like 8 months of Charles Darwin printing The Origin of Species. And that's pretty remarkable. I mean, even in more scientific communities, he was very much ahead of the curve. And I thought, well, this is like perfect. It's intellectual. It's right here in South Carolina. excuse me, right here in South Carolina. We have his papers. The rest of his papers are just one state away in Georgia. Like, perfect. And I stuck with it and forced it upon, I forced it into a topic that was thesis appropriate.
So would you say that those resources here in South Carolina really helped you complete that project?
Definitely. It goes back to me being a pretty pragmatic person. You know, I know it's always that fine line. Do you want to do something that all the sources are there for you and it's just sort of easy, but maybe it's not the most 100% compelling, you love it topic? Or do you want to pick the perfect topic and then have to travel 8 hours and call archivists in 7 different libraries, you know, over the course of a year? And I thought, it's not worth it. This is the location that I picked. I should find a topic here in this location. I should be able to make the local history work. If I'm a public historian and I can't find a local history topic that I'm interested in, then maybe I'm not a very good public historian. Well, so, so the fact that South Carolina has the Caroliniana Library, and the fact that they have pretty robust digital collections. So, yeah, that's always helpful, because even if you're going to wind up going into the library or the archives anyway, if you can like sit there safely in your bedroom and like look for stuff before you make the trek to campus, that's always a plus. So for sure, that was positive and definitely a deciding factor that there was, you know, most of his presidential papers and a number of his personal papers at the university.
Well, it seems like you certainly made it work for the situation you were in. So let's talk a little bit about your outside of the classroom and kind of academe experience. So where did you complete your internships or your assistantships?
So my first year, I had a split assistantship. So I was a grading only TA, as well as working at the digital collections department, which I think was called digital activities, but I've worked at like 3 different university digital collections, so I couldn't tell. And when I looked at my resume yesterday, I was like, they all just say digital collections. I think I just put digital collections for everywhere I worked. So that was fun. It wasn't what I expected when I applied for the program, but I TA'd for, oh my gosh, I can't even remember his name. That's terrible. Dr. Kinsley, Dean Kinsley. I TA'd for Dean Kinsley as a grader only for his East Asia classes, which was interesting because I had, as a teacher, been, you know, I had unfortunately done the whole, like, you're only 3 chapters ahead of your students thing, but it had only been as, like, a long-term sub that I'd been thrown into for a biology class, and I hate to say that I didn't really care all that much, but I didn't really care all that much, whereas for this, I was like, oh my god, I don't know anything about East Asian history, and part of, but I remember someone saying, like, well, part of the reason you were assigned to that is because you used to be a world history teacher. And I was like, yeah, we didn't talk about East Asia at all. We talked about China for, like, 1 chapter in my whole world history book that I taught. So the expectation, I guess, of what I knew about literal world history as opposed to what was actually me teaching Western Civ was a little interesting. And then, as I said, I worked in digital collections, mostly just scanning and documenting metadata, a little bit of creating metadata, but mostly just documenting metadata that had been given to me from librarians. And then my second year, my assistantship was with Teaching American History South Carolina when they still had the grant at South Carolina Archives and History. And I think that was the last year that federal grant was there at the archives.
Oh, excellent. So how beneficial were these assistantships to either your coursework or your eventual career, or both?
So honestly, my first year assistantships as a TA and working at Digital Collections was not particularly useful. I'd worked in Digital Collections before doing the same, if not more, high-level things prior. And being a TA was fine, but grading papers on East Asian history wasn't the most useful in my museum career. My second assistantship at Teaching American History, which I really wanted, there were only two positions available for the grant, and when I had started, both of them were filled by current students, and so I like really lobbied hard to be the student who replaced one of the outgoing students when she finished her program, and that was definitely beneficial. Besides creating. So we created curriculum related to archival materials, and then we also served as mentors to teachers around South Carolina in counties all over the state who weren't necessarily the strongest social studies teachers and were trying to not only become stronger social studies teachers, but also to incorporate primary sources. Mm-hmm. And at both of my positions, since leaving the program, I have worked with teachers in different but certainly similar capacities where you're helping them use primary sources and use artifacts and objects more thoughtfully with their students. So that was extremely helpful.
Excellent. So I think that's a great transition into talking a little bit more about what you've been doing since you left USC. And so how did your career develop after you left the program?
So my internship was at the Nantucket Historical Association, and when March or April of my second year was coming around and I had finished my thesis and was starting to apply for jobs, I was having zero luck. And at the NCPH conference that year, the person who'd been my internship supervisor at the Historical Association was there, and we went out for a drink or lunch or something, and he asked how the job hunt was going, and I said, not well. I've only been offered one interview of, like, you know, however many applications I've sent out, and it was for the Antique Boat Museum on the California side of Lake Tahoe, which, like, It wasn't for me anyway. Like, they didn't want me, but I was just, you know, grasping at straws at that point. And he said, well, you know, we don't have our full seasonal staff yet, so why don't you come on for the season? We can keep you on Nantucket until Columbus Day, and you can help manage the youth family space in the museum do some other things for the department, and, you know, that'll be it. But by then you'll have found a job. You're very competent. You'll find one. Well, I went to Nantucket and applied for some jobs, obviously, throughout the summer, and did receive a few interviews. And October came and went, and I had not been offered a permanent position yet. And they still had enough money in the budget to pay me the very small amount that they were paying me. And so no one said anything, and so I just stayed. And at that point in time, I had started dating someone on island. And so it was like I didn't really want to leave. But I was continuing to apply for jobs off island, and I was offered a position with the state of Arizona, which I would have taken. But it was in Phoenix, and living in a city of 4 million people just would be a lot for me. Not that Las Vegas is small, but, like, this is the biggest place I've ever lived, and I didn't need to be anywhere twice the size. So I told the Nantucket Historical Association, like, I got this job offer, and I'd rather be here, but unless you hire me on permanently full time, I'm gonna have to take this job in Arizona in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So they offered me a position, and I started there. So my permanent position officially began at the end of December of 2011. 11, so I guess that's what, like 7 months after I finished, I had a real job, which is exciting, not too bad. I wasn't the first in my cohort by any means, but I wasn't the last, so there's that. And I stayed there through two promotions. I was there for about 4 years, and I served as our manager of education for the majority of the time that I was there, which for the Nantucket Historical Association meant all of our youth, family, and school programs, as well as any kind of like special group tour, as opposed to like a family reunion or things like that. And then I also coordinated our summer internship program, which was fun because I'd been an intern. And then and then I had the opportunity to move back to Las Vegas in July of last year, so 2015. I moved back here before I actually had a job at the Mob Museum, which is where I work now. But I moved back for family reasons, and I was pretty certain that I was going to be offered a position at the Mob Museum. They had applied for a grant to create a new school outreach program, and I had been the only person that they interviewed for it, and it was like, I'm pretty sure they're going to get this grant. The city of Las Vegas was the grant agency, and they had been very instrumental in creating the Mob Museum, so it was like, you know, 98% sure they were going to get this grant. And so I'm the education outreach manager at the Mob Museum, and I primarily started there just to create this school outreach program, but now I do, now I create most of our interpretive and educational content and help with a little bit of exhibit development, not a whole lot, but a little bit. We don't have like a full-time like curator who focuses on creating exhibits. We have a curatorial staff who handles all of our objects and caring for our objects, but when the Mob Museum opened, it's only 5 years old, and all of the exhibits were created by an outside exhibit development team. So they were like, oh, we don't need like a curator of content. Like, nah, we just need like a curator to like handle the accessions and stuff and work with the collections manager. Like, that's all we need. So now they're realizing like, huh, okay, well, that means other people have to do this whenever we need to make content changes to any of our exhibit scripts or updating our exhibits in any way. So mostly our director of content, my supervisor, does that, but I do a little bit.
And you mentioned earlier that, I mean, you don't work with very many, you know, professionally trained public historians or even like experientially trained public historians. And it seems to be a relatively young museum. So what is it like, you know, kind of, again, working with such a large number of non-public history type folks? Like, what other challenges do you run into? Or pleasant surprises?
Yeah, it's definitely good and bad. I am a firm believer that varied experience makes you better at anything you're doing. And I mean, I think, certainly not to the extent that the Mob Museum staff, you know, sort of embodies this, but I know that one thing that Allison Marsh was, you know, always very clear about was it was like, it doesn't matter if you've got a PhD or a master's or nothing at all, like, you can work in a museum, you need to get with it, you gotta learn the lingo, you gotta learn the you know, experiential skills. And I think it's true, like, my supervisor, our director of content, had never worked in a museum before, but he is an extremely knowledgeable person on local history. He's written a number of books on local history, including one that I read in college about Las Vegas, which is always fun. And he'd worked as a newspaper editor, and it's like, who can write succinct historical information better than someone who is a newspaper editor? Like, he totally gets how to write an object label without it wind up being, you know, 70 words long, and I love it. But there's definitely things that I feel like I sort of take for granted, and then I realize that I have to remind people about. We have a pretty sizable teaching collection. We have like a total of, and a lot of these are postcards and stuff, but we have a total of like 350 objects in our teaching collection. And the idea that just because it's a teaching collection doesn't mean that some random volunteer can be let into the content closet, can just walk up with a, you know, 70-year-old bulletproof vest, like holding on to it with their bare hands, is something that I have to constantly remind people. It's like every week me and our curator of collections has to tell someone, like, nope, you can't use that unless you have a trained educator or one of us. Nope, I don't care that a news crew's coming. Like, you can use it, but again, you have to have one of the trained educators or one of us. And yeah, even with my boss, sometimes he'll say, like, well, we can just take that out of the Mylar sleeve. Like, tell them to take it out, like, whenever they want. And I'm like, nope, only me. Only I'm taking it out of the Mylar sleeve. Like, if I'm out with a group of guests and I make the educated decision to take it out of the Mylar sleeve, then I will. But not everyone can make that decision. And a lot of times, I don't think museums are a field that have like an obnoxious amount of jargon, but I'll definitely say some things on occasion that people are just like, that was meaningless to me. Like, what is historiography? What are you talking about? Like, what is that a thing? Are you just like mispronouncing history? Are you mispronouncing like hagiography? What are you doing? So, so it can be a challenge, but I think, I have only worked in museums that have a heavy tourist visitation. Even at the Nantucket Historical Association, Nantucket is a tourist destination. So even though it sounds like we were just a boring local history organization, our flagship property, the Whaling Museum, you know, like 95% of all the visitors who ever went through there that weren't school groups were tourists. So to me, it's kind of like when you're in an institution like that, you need public historians. You need at least a few. But you also need people who are like, hey, but tourists expect this and this and that. Speaking of what tourists expect, though, the biggest shock to me when I started the Mob Museum from like the difference when you're not working with a lot of museum people, guests can eat and drink anywhere in our exhibits, including alcohol, including red wine. So, literally none of our objects are not in some sort of glass or, you know, plexiglass case. So it's not like, you know, we have a rope and they can like accidentally spill chips on the other side of it. So it's not as terrible as it sounds from a museum perspective, but it's pretty shocking.
Yeah, it's still surprising.
Our curator of collections said the same thing when I first started, the very first time that someone like pointed out like, oh yeah, we serve beer and all this stuff. And I'm like, so where do they drink the beer? And they're like, in the exhibit space. And the curator of collection is standing there and she's like, I know, don't tell them how weird and horrible it is. They don't need to know. I've already told them.
Oh, goodness. So what do you think is the most unexpected way your time at USC helped you professionally?
Oh, my God. That's a good question, but also one I didn't prepare for. You know, I think more than anything, it's just the ability to have that sounding board, especially being in a place where there aren't tons of museum professionals, both in my physical museum and in the state that I live in. I know whenever I have a question that there's like literally 40 people that I can immediately like either tag on Facebook or email or text. And some of them are professors that I had. Some of them are students that were there at the same time as me. Some of them are alumni who I knew when I was a student. And that's just so cool. I mean, when I started the Mob Museum, the idea for the outreach program was that it would become these history trunks, and we would repurpose some of the objects in the teaching collection that they'd already started, and take them out as trunks. And I had tons of experience in museum education. I shouldn't say tons. I had a couple of years of experience in museum education, but I had not worked with any kind of trunks or teaching collections, but I knew that it's a well-established thing. I mean, museums have literally been doing it for like 30 or 40 years. So the first thing I did was send an email out to like 6 different friends who I knew from USC who had similar programs at their museums or historical societies. I posted something on Facebook and tagged like another 10 people or so that I've gone to grad school with who I thought, well, maybe their institution has it and I just don't know about it. And I guess that shouldn't be so surprising, but it is. I mean, I didn't necessarily think about the idea of networking from grad school being so immediate. And I just feel like USC has the resources that whenever I have a question, it gets answered. And I don't know if other students feel, other alumni and as well as current students feel this way, but whenever I get an email from Bob or Allison or Connie or any of the other professors who are like, hey, here's this student and they need this thing and we think that you can help them, I'm always like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to help them. And I think that's the aspect of it that was surprising to me. Obviously, you're going to go to grad school and you're going to build this networking community and you're going to meet all these people. But I just feel like it's to me, it's so rewarding, and it's rewarding from both ends. It's like I get to say, oh, well, I got this idea from my USC connections. So, you know, here you go.
Well, it seems to be like a very productive and supportive community. And I'm getting that kind of feedback from a lot of different alums that I've spoken to. So I'm so glad that I asked the unexpected question because I had a great response from you. So I have just a couple of closing questions. We have a few more minutes here, but we're almost done. You're doing great. I'm loving what we've got here. So if you could make a suggestion to the public history program at USC or public history programs in general, what would you say? Just about anything.
So I think that the major thing that I would say is whatever you can do to continue to give students in the field training is going to be the most beneficial. I learned so many things from my classes, and I liked being in grad classes. I'm not going to say I loved it because, I mean, it's still emotionally and intellectually taxing, but I enjoyed it, and I liked it, and I learned a lot. But ultimately, in the public history field, unless you're doing those practical, experiential, hands-on things, most of the time what you learn in school is a backbone, but it's not what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And, I mean, USC is not known for its museum education focus, so certainly I have less opportunity to apply what I learned than, say, a curator or a collections manager. But even for my alumni friends who are curators or collection managers, I feel like everyone agrees the school's important, but having those connections, being able to say, yes, you can do your assistantships at the Relic Room and McKissick and the archives and wherever else, is the most important thing that USC can do. And we're living in a different time now from a grant perspective and from a funding perspective than maybe 10 years ago or even 7 years ago. But that would be the one thing that I it's not a change. It's just don't let that change.
Right. Keep doing this important thing.
Exactly.
So do you have a vision kind of for the future of public history as a field? Where do you think we're headed?
Well, I think the one challenge that we really have is we've gotten to a point of near saturation as far as the number of people who are completing bachelor's and master's and PhDs in public history, and our ability as an industry to then give them jobs. I mean, essentially the public history field was created to give all these intellectuals in the 70s and 80s who couldn't find tenured positions jobs. And they were like, hey, don't you realize you can go work in a museum or a SHPO office and you'll get to do the same kind of stuff you love? You won't be tenured, but it'll be almost as good. And now we've essentially done that with public history. I mean, and I say that, I kind of feel like anyone who goes to USC gets the opportunity to say that, because it's like we've been around for so long as a program. I can tell these other schools, like, oh, you've only been a public history program for 10 years, like you're ruining this for the rest of us, which is terrible. And a lot of recent programs are great. I mean, like the University of Louisville's public history program is, I think, only like 10 years old, and I would never say, like, don't have that program, I'm mad at you. It's a wonderful program. But what worries me is that we've created all of these historians who have practical, applicable, real-world skills, but we still don't have practical, applicable, real-world jobs for them. And so I think, I hate to sit in my ivory-employed tower and say, you know, we got to really rethink who we're admitting and what we're doing. But I think that the public history field in general has to be very selective about those people who are being admitted to the programs and what they want out of the program. I know just in my cohort, there were, and this is not, you know, a negative attack on anyone I went to school with, but there were definitely a few people who were like, well, I like history, and this seems like, you know, it'll be easier to find a job in my hometown than if I try to become a professor. And, you know, that's a real problem. It's not that they shouldn't or couldn't or don't deserve to be public historians, but I think that we've gotten to a point where we have to say, what are the goals of this applicant, of this student, of this public historian, and be a little more selective. And I also think that it's important to advocate for the ability for public history students to use their skills in other fields and not let that be like a disappointment. I mean, I think I was a history major and undergrad, and I remember all the posters in our in the liberal arts college saying, like, you can become a lawyer or an anthropologist or these other things that are only sort of like the major that you're studying. And I think, you know, that's sort of true of public historians. You don't have to be a museum or a archivist or a preservation officer. You can be a writer. You can be a PR person. You can be all these things. I don't know. It's tough because no one wants to be only 30 years old and be so curmudgeon-y about up-and-comers. I love up-and-comers. I love mentoring people and knowing that there's new public history people entering the world, entering the cohort of public historians. But it's not the guaranteed job that it was when USC created the applied history program, you know, 40 years ago.
Right. So kind of any parting thoughts, things that we haven't covered that you would love to mention and have on the record, or anything like that?
I was thinking about whether there is going to be a way for me to bring this up, but I feel like this is really important because if Bob Wyneth one day listens to my oral history and doesn't hear me talk about this, I think he'll be very upset. So when I was when I came to USC, I had a number of professional experiences that I think definitely contributed to my ability to become a public historian. As a teacher, I'd worked in digital collections. But the only museum position that I'd had was at the Liberace Museum. Liberace, the big gay piano player from the mid-century. It doesn't exist anymore. The museum closed in 2010. That's right, 1 year after I started my graduate program. Liberace himself had founded the museum. And the whole time that I was at USC, every time that Bob Wyneth introduced me to any person, he introduced me and said, "We only admitted Claire because she'd worked at the Liberace Museum." And to this day, whenever I'm talking to one of my friends from my cohort, they're always like, "Oh, it's you. You were only admitted because of the Liberace Museum." Or they're like, "Man, remember when Bob used to always tell complete strangers that the only reason you were admitted because you worked at the Liberace Museum?" And I have to say, I think that if it wasn't for Bob, as the years went by, I would have sort of purposefully sloughed off my identity as having started my museum career at the Liberace Museum. But no, because of him, it's really confirmed my resolve that I am proud and unembarrassed about my Liberace Museum experience. So that is totally, it involves Dr. Wyneth, so it's not totally unrelated to the program, but it's a little unrelated. But I think that's important. I mean, if you're looking, like if someone's listening to this oral history 20 years from now and they're looking for a real money shot quote, me telling that story about Dr. Wyneth and Liberace, I hope will be that for some sweet graduate student in 20 years.
Well, I think we all have our roots, right? The things that we did for yes, 3 months yeah. or a little like here or there that come up on our resumes if you get to a certain number of pages. Well, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you so much, Claire. We really appreciate that you would take the time to do this and, you know, leave this record for, you know, all the graduate students this year and in 20 years from now, anyone that wants to pull it. So I'm going to go ahead and shut this recording off and talk to you a little bit about the release, okay?
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.